Welcome again to the Milt Rosenberg podcast. And as I've been saying lately, it is no matter of accident that the voice you hear is that of Milt Rosenberg. But shortly you'll hear the voices of two old friends, Charles Lipson, one of our original A-team, leading American political scientist and based at the University of Chicago, just back from 10 days or so in China, which has nothing to do with what we're talking about tonight. And Martin Kramer, who is an old associate. He's served time even at the University of Chicago as a visiting professor. Basically, his career, and it's a distinguished academic career, has been in Israel, where these days he is president of Shalem College, the only liberal arts college in the country, but for many years associated with Tel Aviv University and various other organizations, and in the process, one of the major contributors to an analysis of Middle East and Israeli affairs in the general context of contemporary politics. And speaking of contemporary politics, Martin, it remains a puzzlement, just as the world was, or the outside world was, for the once king of Siam. What in the world on this day, and this day I should make clear, is September 12th, of 2014, one day after the September 11th commemoration. What in the world is really going on around and in and through that which we now call ISIS?
Well, ISIS doesn't call itself ISIS anymore. ISIS calls itself simply the Islamic State, IS. And their claim is to universal sovereignty, not over...
Of the world.
Of the world, not just Iraq and Sham or Syria, but they certainly over the entire region itself.
The coming caliphate ultimately of the world in total.
In Islamic political theory, the caliphate knows no territorial bounds. It is a universal caliphate. There have been various theoreticians who at various times have said that if a sea separates two caliphs, there could be two. But the standard and classic version is that there should only be one. So this is, although it calls itself the Islamic State, it's really an anti-state. That is, it rejects the whole state system in favor of the creation of a universal caliphate. A distant prospect at this point in time, but a nascent movement.
The concept is really that of an ultimate theocracy.
It is of a theocracy. I think more important is that it's a rejection of the order with which the Middle East has been structured around for close to 100 years.
And what is that structure, if I may ask, Martin? What is the structure being rejected?
Well, the structure is a system of territorial states, numerous territorial states, on the territory which once was part and parcel of the Great Caliphate, both the classic caliphate and then the Ottoman Caliphate. So it's a rejection of what they see as an arbitrary division of this part of the world by imperial powers into statelets whose existence is meant to serve the aims of imperialism.
The world has been somewhat shocked. America surely has been somewhat shocked by the degree of systematic violence, terror, murder is the proper word, undertaken as a matter of policy, obviously. Not only the two Americans executed in videos, beheaded in videos, but we've seen other videos of dozens, hundreds of recently taken prisoners, or some of them maybe even civilians, just grabbed because they are not of the right faith or of the right intensity of faith, and lined up on the ground and shot down, shot dead. It rather looks like the early phase of the Holocaust before they built the murder factories. It begins to raise the basic question, which has been in the air for some time. What ultimately is Islam about? Is it conceivable, despite what many fine Islamic preachers and apologists say constantly, that they are a religion of peace, which is now being misused by certain fanatics, is it possible that terrorist murder is the ultimate default position of Islam itself?
Well, first of all, let's put the violence that we've seen from the Islamic State in its Middle Eastern context. Is what we've seen any different than the way in which Saddam Hussein, for example, They persecuted both Shiites and Kurds, including, by the way, I remind all, the use of poison gas. Is it any different than the way in which the Assad regime in Damascus has taken the lives of close to 200,000 people since the outbreak of war there, including, again, the use of chemical weapons,
just
barrel
as the father,
bombs.
Just as the elder Assad did in an earlier instance Syrian history.
So it's a variation on a theme. I don't think it's original at all. It's a variation on a theme. And the theme is goes back, I think, to the premise of one of my late mentors, Fuad Ajami, who said that in the Middle East, you rule or you die. So it's a zero-sum game in which you attempt to inflict upon your adversaries such pain and such horror that they will desist from challenging your power.
And with this kind of terror, kill everybody that you capture, opposing armies fade away. That seems to be what happened with the Iraqi army only in the last month or two.
It is true that they are fading away, also because, to some extent, they're not defending their core homeland. You see, once you have a total breakdown along sectarian lines, everybody says, well, yes, there's an Iraq, but there's my Iraq and there's the rest of Iraq. I will defend my Iraq, but I won't necessarily defend with my life all of Iraq.
What is my Iraq for the Iraqi army?
For the part of the Iraqi army, which is Shiite, my Iraq begins in Baghdad and goes southward and doesn't extend into the western desert of Iraq, which is the Sunni heartland. And so what we have here are really people fighting for their ethnic and sectarian homelands. And it's very hard to get people who have been sectarianized to actually offer their life in defense of a state whose borders are arbitrary and in defense of territory which is not their home. So what is true is that you've had the melting away of the Iraqi army. The Syrian army doesn't even try at this point to recapture those areas which are in ISIS control. The only people who have a real determination to carve this out as their sectarian heartland is ISIS.
That is the present, quote, Islamic State.
Right.
Portion of Syria, significant portion of Iraq. Is it here to stay for quite a while?
It's here to stay as long as there's no one to destroy it. Until this point, the Islamic State has had a pretty free hand. It's operated mostly in desert areas. It's conquered a couple of cities, Raqqa in Syria and Mosul in Iraq. But otherwise, it's in areas that most people paid little attention to.
They just took a Lebanese town.
For a time a Lebanese town. And they want to expand outward. But they got started in a vacuum in which neither of the regional states, Syria or Iraq, had a great interest. And the United States and the Western powers had no great interest. And that's the key to understanding the ISIS phenomenon, looking for the vacuums and filling them.
Charles Lipson.
This is a brilliant analysis that you've laid out, Martin. It seems to me that the one positive element is to think back about what David Petraeus did during the surge. We all understand that the American part of the surge, but what really made it all work was the Anbar Awakening, namely that the tribal militias who are Sunni in that part of Iraq rose up against this kind of dreadful Sharia rule by outsiders. And that's still a possibility here. In fact, the only possibility, as far as I see, those tribal leaders who've stood aside as ISIS has moved through, and they were backed by the Americans with close air support. That could still happen. There was a lot of bribery from us to them. That could still happen. But that won't happen in Syria. I want to turn to one of the subjects that Milt was talking about, which was the kind of killing. Marching these people off very much, as I said, like the Jews were marched off in Poland and places to dig their own graves and then shot and killed. But what really struck the American public was beheadings. It was journalists, to be sure, and that may have played a bigger role. That is, it got more play on our media because they were journalists. But it was the beheadings. Could you say something about the symbolic role of beheadings and why that seems to be a certain kind of killing? It has a visceral impact on others, but it seems to be something that is done for a particular reason, and I've never quite understood it, and maybe you can clarify it.
Well, the reason is that they believe in everything they do that they are reenacting chapters in Islamic history, in the glorious, most glorious chapters of Islamic history. The Prophet Muhammad also beheaded his adversaries, and sometimes prisoners as well. And it's well recorded in the Islamic sacred texts, including a Jewish tribe, I might add. The men were all executed by beheading. So from their point of view, the whole process in which they are engaged in is a reenactment of earlier glorious history. And that's a symbolism for them. Now, we look at it from the outside and we see something different. We see something that's a throwback to some other age.
A kind of primitive barbarism.
Right. Now,
let us not forget the French Revolution.
And the French Revolution.
And the invention of the guillotine.
Actually, beheading was, it was a kind of a modernizing measure.
And the English Revolution.
That the French believed that they'd innovated. In fact, it has a long history in Islam. The interesting thing about the comparison, as you mentioned, with the Holocaust is that both the Nazi Germany and Saddam Hussein carried out mass executions, marched people off and killed them with bullets to the head or whatever, but they tried to conceal what they were doing. These people are not trying to conceal what they're doing. They're filming it. They're putting it in YouTube. And it's because what they believe it does is it magnifies for Muslim and Arab viewers the power that they claim to have. And they regard themselves as completely free of accountability to any Western notion of what is or isn't proper in warfare.
That's and the best explanation I've heard of that, and I appreciate it.
And it really also absolutely punctures all opposition, doesn't it?
It has the effect of terrorizing people into submission. And Charlie rightly mentioned that to some extent we've been here before. There was Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which attempted to oppose itself in the Sunni areas, the tribes rose up, but they didn't just do it with air support. They didn't just do it with the political support of the United States.
There was a surge. Over the horizon
killing. There was a surge. There was a surge. So they said, all right, we've got Al-Qaeda in Iraq, but on the other hand, there's another countervailing power. We can tilt the balance if we ally ourselves with a countervailing power, which is that of the United States. Now, at the present moment in time, there is no countervailing power. So what they're more likely to do, and what we see them doing, is cutting deals with the Islamic State.
Who is the they?
The tribal leaders over cutting deals with the Islamic State, which is willing, in fact, unlike Al-Qaeda in Iraq, to establish an administration. Right? They want to administer the country according to Sharia law, but also to provide all the services and so forth and so on. So they are cutting deals now with the tribal leaders who, looking around them, don't want to cooperate with the Iraqi government, which they see as Shiite-dominated, and don't see the United States except flying at high altitudes, putting the area under surveillance.
You're saying there is practical political consideration leading many tribal leaders into alliance with the Islamic State, at least for the present. Is there also an ideological surge, quote, on the Arab street or in the Arab desert, for that matter? Is this the new, or rather the revived face of absolutely terror-based Islamic expansion?
What we're seeing across the region is the decline of Arab nationalism and its replacement with Islamism, all sorts of varieties of Islamism.
With Islamic internationalism, so to speak.
Islamic, called Islamic internationalism, Islamic nationalism also. Yeah. Islamism is the word that most scholars use. And if Arab nationalism was the default position.
The Nasser position.
Right, the Nasser position and its variants. You had the Saddam version, the Assad version. These were all versions of Arab nationalism, many of which were in conflict with one another. But if that was the default position for an earlier generation.
What was it? Just stop for a second.
Right.
What it was the core position of Arab nationalism so we can distinguish it from what you're saying now?
The core position of Arab nationalism was the Arabs constituted a nation based on their linguistic and cultural affinity.
So they weren't just Egypt and Libya and Syria. Okay.
Right. And in fact, one of the main objectives of Arab nationalism was the unification of the Arabs. You'll recall that Nasser himself brought about a unity
but
between
unified
Syria
in a secular way
and Egypt. But it was a predominantly secular movement. It had some Islamic overtones, but it was predominantly secular. And the idea was that if the Arabs united, they could face the colonialism, which continued even after formal independence, to decide the fate of the Arab world, particularly backing mm-hmm. Israel. The change here is that young people say that it was the abandonment of faith which weakened the Arabs. And it weakened them through the medium of Arab nationalism. And if Arabs and Muslims would only return to their faith, they would be empowered again.
Where's the intellectual base for all of this?
The intellectual base goes back to the 40s and 50s, when you had a number of theoreticians who came up with this notion. The Arabs don't face imperialism in its modern form. They face what is actually a kind of crusaderism. It's called by the West and even by its Western critics empire. But what it is really is just a replay of the old religious hostility to Islam. And so Muslims have to rally around Islam to push back.
Put this in longer historical context. I know that one of your teachers was Bernard Lewis.
Still is.
Still is.
The great Bernard
Lewis.
He's
into his mid-90s, I believe, by now.
He is, at this point, he's 98 years old.
98, yeah. At Princeton. And he's taken the long view as to what has happened to Islam over the last five.
Indeed, he wrote the book, What Went Wrong.
Exactly. And that's the book I have in mind. Relate this to the larger Lewisian view.
In the larger view, what we see now is a profound disappointment with the fruits of modernity in the Arab and Muslim world. They were told that if they modernized, they would become powerful.
As once they were.
So they modernized. They did it selectively, of course. There's some aspects which they borrowed and some they didn't take. They didn't go as far as Atatürk in Turkey, who took wholesale everything. But they created, I would call, a hybrid modernization, which they borrowed elements which they thought would strengthen them. Some secularism was part of the mix. Openness to technology, changing the status of women, all sorts of things. And they have been disappointed. Not only have they not gotten stronger, but relative to other rising parts of the world, for example, East Asia, they're actually weaker than they were a century ago. And so we have this profound disaffection, disillusionment, and disappointment. And how does it manifest itself? We made a mistake. We embraced modernity. It disappointed us. So let's find something else. Let's go back to our true roots.
I think there's something very important here about the failure of what they would consider the failure of Arab nationalism. There was a failure. It didn't succeed. And it was that, it seems to me, that set the stage for what came next. If it had succeeded in the same sense that modernization succeeded in Japan, after Japan was opened in the late 19th century, there was a distinctive Japan version of modernity. We know it all crashed and burned during imperialism in the Second World War, but it's revived. There is now a Chinese path to modernity, and at least so far, it has succeeded. It didn't succeed in the Arab world. So there's a search for something different. One possibility was to say, we didn't do it the right way. We should have modernized in different and more effective ways. And one place that's trying to do that in a different way, combining an element of Islamic, a strong element of Islamic ideology, but economic modernization, is Turkey. And I wonder if any of them look to Turkey as a successful model. Erdogan's Turkey.
Well, Turkey actually took a different path than the Arabs took. Under Atatürk, they went for wholesale westernization. They shed the clothing, including
The fez, yeah.
They discarded the Arabic-based alphabet, which they had. They declared the equality. They declared the equality of women. The Arab world's modernization was partial. Oh, and by the way, one more thing that Turks did was ultimately they implemented a democratic system, with free elections. So they took all that because they had been over centuries more exposed to European ways in any event. It was easier for them to take on these attributes of
Europe. And that was strongly advocated and defended by the Turkish military.
That's right. The Arabs never had their Ataturk. Nasser never went as far as Ataturk did in his reforms. He did some land reforms. He did some modernization. He tried to upgrade the status of women, but he never went as far as Ataturk because the Arabs believed that their traditions were so important to them that they could find a middle way. Perhaps, as Charles indicated, the Chinese did or the Japanese did. They would find a middle way. The problem is that the middle way they found failed. Now, just to finish his thought, was there some other thing they could have done which would have made it succeed? And there are people in the Arab world who say yes, the area in which we failed to modernize and which was most important was in the way in which we govern ourselves. We never embraced democratic, pluralistic government. And so you have a small number of people, let's call them the liberals, who oppose the Islamists and say, no, the way to power isn't to go back to Islam. It's to go that step we never took.
Those are the people you see on CNN.
That's right.
They find the six of them who are in Tahrir Square and interview all of them because they speak English. And then the American public and perhaps the Europeans as well infer that they represent a much larger fraction of the public than they actually do.
What is the Arab mass mind these days? I know it would vary from country to country, but overall, what do we really have? Do we have a general urge, regressive in its quality, back to authentic, true nativist, fundamentalist doctrine in the Quran, in classic Islam, and then translated or transmuted into the sort of political program we now see, which is to knock over anything that is a vestige of democracy and establish firm authoritarian Sharia-based law? Incidentally, looking forward once again to reviving the intention to destroy Israel, which we haven't mentioned yet in this conversation.
We have a culture war between two sides. In each country, the balance is different. Look at Egypt. Egypt had Muslim Brotherhood rule briefly after the fall of Hosni Mubarak.
And
people
the military
saw,
got
people
rid
saw
of it.
The chaos that ensued.
Yeah. 20
and gave,
million people gathered to protest it.
And at the end of the day, the military came back, the strong man back in power, the pharaoh, if you will, conforming to an also very old tradition in Egypt. So in Egypt, you have one model, and they're aligned also with the Saudis, who have a monarchy, and who say our kind of rule is the only stopgap between us and chaos. And on the other hand, you have the Islamists who say return to the Sharia is the only way in which we will empower ourselves.
But there's something quite paradoxical there. This is merely a side note or a sidebar. But it is confusing just what the Saudis are really up to. Because at the same time, Wahhabism, their version of Salafism, their version of Islamic fundamentalism and Islamic restoration has been funded by them to the extent of multi-billions around the world. They are, in many ways, the funders, the founders, and the propagandists for this kind of regressive return to, quote, pure aggressive Islam, even though they are frightened of it.
Well, the Saudis have a particular view of this, and it's that it's only the way they define true Islam that matters, not what they define in the Islamic State or in Iran or any place else.
So how do they define it?
So they have used some of their money in order to influence other groups.
Really
to bring
pernicious.
Them.
Wherever it spreads around the world, it's been a force for all kinds of conflict.
And in many cases for blowback for themselves. They themselves. By
That's
the way,
my
the
point.
Biggest the biggest fence, point. The biggest border fence being built right now in the Middle East is between Saudi Arabia and Iraq and Syria, because they don't want the Islamic State overflowing in their direction, even though there are some princes in Saudi Arabia who have funded these people.
Well, that's it. I was about to ask, is this possibly a matter of trouble inside the family, the vast royal family? Are there different factions, different princely factions, some which favor resisting all of the trend towards regressive Islam, and others who in fact favor it, support it, fund it, and are enthusiastic for it?
Well, the Saudis have a view that there can be a Sharia-based system, but it has to be open to the West, and it has to be open to the idea of monarchy. They don't call themselves caliphs.
Yeah.
They're kings, right? So that's the Saudi model. And the fact is, though, that some of their money winds up in the hands of people who have a different vision. And now they've realized themselves, they realized it even when Al-Qaeda emerged, that's why they expelled Osama bin Laden, is that it can blow back against them. Osama bin Laden, you'll remember, after having been so close to the Saudis, then turned against them. And what's important here is that the Saudis in this battle at the moment are aligned with Egypt and the existing order. Now, the question is whether the United States and others can bring about a mobilization of this full mobilization of the Saudis against groups like the Islamic State, Hamas and others. And I think that there's a chance for that because, look, if you are the protector of the holy places in Mecca and Medina, who is a threat to you on the theological level? A man in Iraq who claims to be the caliph of the Muslims. Baghdadi is his name. And obviously, from the Saudi point of view, this is a threat to them as well. And what we have to do is build a coalition which will help them be part of the mobilization against it. They already have the motive.
By the way, sidebar number two, who exactly is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the supposed leader and inspirer of this whole new Islamic State?
He's a man with a very thin theological education who worked his way up through through Al-Qaeda in Iraq. I have to say that having seen him speak, he doesn't impress me as being all that charismatic. But in some respect, he was the last man standing. Remember that some of the other key figures, such as Zarqawi and others, were eliminated. I think he has a kind of totemic value as being the figurehead of the state. But he does have considerable organizational skills. It was a particularly brazen move to take personally the caliphate upon himself, because everyone looks to the caliph as a personal exemplar. Baghdadi has a pretty thin record, but then he doesn't have a lot going against him either.
We are 2 days away at this moment from President Obama's speech, laying out his, quote, strategy. Three of us certainly watched it, heard it, as did the world. What exactly is the significance of that strategy as he elaborated it just two nights ago? Charles Lipson.
Well, the reason we can't answer that for sure is that in order to have an effective strategy, the president would in effect have to renounce everything that he's done in the 6 years of his presidency up to now. He had a strategy for the Middle East. It began with his speech in Cairo, and it was part of a larger strategy, which was a friendly outreach to traditional adversaries that would have been particularly—
And it also started with a kind of apology. We were wrong. We didn't understand.
Absolutely.
You guys.
Apology for the Bush administration, sort of an apology for what America had done throughout its history
exactly. In
the region and the West had done. So we were apologizing in particular to Iran. And notice that what that meant was that when there was a popular uprising in Iran in 2009, instead of backing it, we spoke in a friendly way and actually used the term, the formal term of the Islamic State of Iran and so forth. We reached out to the Muslim Brotherhood and its offshoot Hamas. By the way, both of these things just absolutely terrified the Saudis and pushed them much further away from America. The U.S. withdrew abruptly all of its troops from Iraq. What did that mean? It meant that the groups which had finally, at long last, after the surge in Anbar Awakening, had begun not to trust each other, but at least to trust America, were willing to form something like a fragile unity government there. We not only ripped all of our troops out at once and left them to each other's tender mercies, but we also ripped out all of our intelligence agents, so we were deaf, dumb, and blind there. That left the government in Baghdad, which was a Shia government with no real support except that they looked to their friends in Iran for it. They then formed, in effect, a Sunni militia on steroids and began killing Sunnis. They looked around, and ultimately it was in that context that ISIS was formed. Where does that leave President Obama? It leaves President Obama having done a lot to create the mess. And the question, and having promised that he won't put back in American troops to fight. And you know that you can't drive out successful insurgencies without troops on the ground. So he's got to get local groups. I've said that there's a possibility that he could get those among the tribal leaders who are Sunni in Iraq, but the possibility, not a certainty, but there's no possibility of that working in Syria. And we don't know from President Obama's crisp, clear, and I must say forceful speech, whether he's going to do anything other than bombing and killing to reverse the basic strategic mistakes that have characterized the last 6 years.
Therefore, the way to handle ISIS or Islamic State is what?
Well, I'm not in a position where I'm going to give advice to the present administration. I'm more interested in its underlying assumptions and where they're going wrong.
Mm-hmm.
The underlying assumption of the Obama administration has been that the United States made a mistake getting onshore in the Middle East. It has always been better positioned to defend its interests offshore. And it was a retreat to an offshore position, which was what the Obama administration sought to achieve by withdrawing from Iraq. Now, once you decide to go
back
offshore—
Back to our strategy against the Barbary pirates.
Right. Once you're offshore, which you can argue is it served in the United States well in various periods of time, the question is what you do in relation to the parties that are onshore. Now, you can either back your allies to the hilt with weapons and political support and diplomatic support to make sure they win.
The Mubarak's, we did with Mubarak.
Right. Or, but also the Saudis and Israel, and the whole list is long.
Right.
Or you can say, you know, I'll just try to cut deals with our adversaries.
Which is what Iran, the Obama administration did.
And that's what the Obama administration did. It actually weakened the confidence of its allies in its resolve. Not because it took its soldiers away. Everyone knew the Americans would go. They're not a permanent presence. But by not backing its allies to the hilt. You see, in the Middle East, everyone knows who their friends are and everyone knows who their enemies are. And it's quite clear. You stand by your friends and you oppose your enemies. Obama seemed to America's allies confused. He wanted to make of America's enemies friends. And the way he did it wasn't by threatening them, but was by cajoling them and trying to entice them and appease them. And so this
and
is, I think—
that's failed completely.
This has failed. Now, it's failed completely. Now, ISIS is an interesting case. Now, ISIS didn't exist when Obama formulated his overall approach. It's something new.
And but Al-Qaeda did, and ISIS is begot by Al-Qaeda, is it not?
But there are two ways to pursue this against ISIS. One is to say, you know, we're going to take care of ISIS because it's a threat to American interests. But then how? And in a partnership with whom? You can go after ISIS and still appease Iran, appease Bashar Assad, because they are also potential allies in the battle against ISIS. So the question that I think—
And if you do that, you just drive the Saudis Jordan and all the others right up the wall.
Exactly. And so the question really is, when it comes to ISIS, which of the two alternative paths is Washington going to follow? Is it going to follow the path of bolstering its allies, its long-term allies in this strike? Or is it going to be casting around for new friends in Tehran
That's
and Damascus?
That's why I couldn't answer your question, Milton. Martin put it beautifully. We just don't know. But we do know the instincts of this administration. The president will not back our allies to the hilt. And if you think that he would, look at what he's done in Egypt after the Muslim Brotherhood was overthrown.
Well,
he's refused to do that.
Some of the critical commentary that followed directly upon his speech only two nights ago, was he has indicated really that the policy is to, quote, kick the can down the road for the next president.
Well, he may be kicking the can down the road, but he will be doing a lot of bombing. The problem is an F-16 and a drone are not a strategy. They're simply a tactic. They'll kill people, but they have real limitations and blowback possibilities.
I now will share with you my prophetic dream of last night. Maybe it wasn't a dream, but it was a dream.
Well, we talk about Egypt, and the next thing we know, you're interpreting dreams?
Well, it was a hypnagogic state before I went to sleep.
I see.
How, ultimately, is ISIS to be defeated? 10 years from now, if we're having the same conversation, and looking backward to the rise, the dominance, and then the decline of ISIS or of IS, we will note that basically it was done by the military, not our military, not the German or the English military, but by the Egyptian army and the Turkish army, both of whom are confronted by something which unhinges their definition of Islam and unhinges their sense of separate state sovereignty, and with considerable intelligence assistance and other kinds of hidden assistance by the Israeli military or the Israeli force generally. Is that inconceivable?
It's difficult to conceive. You've named two states, Turkey and Egypt, which decades have passed since they've really projected any meaningful power beyond their own borders. The Turks did it a bit in northern Iraq opposite the Kurds, but the Turks are not are not a state which is anxious to get involved.
Well, the Egyptians projected some military power against Israel and didn't win.
Well, but
they
a couple
produced,
of generations ago.
Yeah.
And on its own territory.
Well, on into the Sinai and so on.
Well, but the Sinai was there, considered their territory.
To be sure.
So these are not the problem with the Middle Eastern states is that they don't very often seek to project power beyond their own borders because they have trouble just controlling their own borders.
Well, my broader point, of course, is that Islamic states have to defeat ISIS because we won't.
Or they have to do it in some kind of partnership with the United States now, or any outside power which is willing to stand up to the. Stand up to the task. What we see now, and here I want to pull back and get the bigger picture, what we might be saying 10 years from now. What we're seeing now is the breakdown of that order that we talked about earlier that's existed for 100 years of the states. And what has emerged, and you have it in Hamas and Hezbollah and the Islamic State, is what I call territorial Islamism. What is territorial Islamism? Well, we know the kind of Islamism that said, let us in the political game, and we want to run in free elections and maybe take over. That's what happened in Egypt, briefly. But Islamists are now saying it doesn't work. We get into the political order, power sharing, we're corrupted, and at the end of the day, they throw us out. What we have to do is seize territory, which is ours, and which we can control, and which we can militarize. And that's what you have in Gaza. That's what you have in parts of Lebanon. And that's what you have in the Islamic State. Islamic groups, they can't seize the whole state, but don't want to be political parties in some a multi-party system. They want political control, and they want to militarize the turf they sit on, build those rockets, implement their own law and their own administration. And so what we're seeing very slowly across the region, and we're going all the way from Gaza on the Mediterranean into the desert in Syria, is we're seeing the territorial Islamic statelets. And then we could be 10 years from now in a situation where there is an Islamic state. It's still there. No one had the wherewithal or the determination or resolve to put it down. And you have a patchwork of these Islamic principalities, all of which host terrorist organizations, are militarized, and are in constant conflict with their neighbors.
And what Hezbollah learned after the 2006 war with Israel is that if you try to extend the borders of that territory into Israel or into a strong state, you're pushed back in a brutal way. The question is whether Hamas will learn that after the punishment that it just took in Gaza, whether it will even survive there. But let me go on and say and answer Milt's question about what we may see in the future. The most hopeful possibility would be that Iraq essentially turns into three coexisting groups.
They follow the Biden plan.
Yes, but with a kind of moderate, but it would still probably have the formal character of an Iraqi state, but with three largely separate territories, a Shia area in the south, a Sunni area ruled by the tribes because of what I mentioned, rather than ISIS, but perhaps
and Kurdistan.
Ruled and Kurdistan, with ISIS in effect pushed back into its civil war in Syria, fighting for the control of the Syrian state. I want to say that we've not mentioned two crucial actors in all of this, and in the remaining time, it might be useful to talk with Martin about them. One is that the spillover of the Syrian war has really jeopardized the stability of the government in Jordan, which is a linchpin to the whole area. And it's not just an external threat in Jordan. There's been a mobilization of Islamicists within Jordan itself. And the other is what to do about Iran. The president himself has made statements about Iran not getting a nuclear weapon that are not, and we won't tolerate that, that are not credible to any actor in the region. I think most people, including most American foreign policy analysts and most Israeli analysts, and I've spoken to both, think that the likely outcome there is that Valerie Jarrett and Barack Obama cut a deal with the Iranians that leave them just short of a nuclear weapon, but one that they could make within a few months, that they call that collapse and appeasement a triumph, and that it leaves everybody else in the region, including the Saudis, petrified, but with no particular options that are effective to act. So I want to turn to what happens to Jordan and what happens to Iran in the time that remains, Martin.
Well, Jordan certainly does face a real challenge from extreme Islamism. Some of the biggest supporters of the fight against the Americans in Iraq had come out of Jordan. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi comes from Zarqa, which is in Jordan, and he was among the leaders. And so there's a certain resonance for these ideas. Now, I wish I had a dollar for every time that someone came along and said that the Jordanian monarchy was in peril. It's been in peril for a long time, and somehow they always find the wherewithal to do what has to be done to protect themselves. This was true of King Hussein of Jordan. This is true of King Abdullah, his son. So and it's a small country. We're not talking about the need to defend endless borders or a large population, which could areas that could spin out of control. It's basically Amman, the capital, and a few other provincial cities, and a border which can be easily defended by a resolute force. So,
and a population, however, that is now majority Palestinian.
It's right? Majority Palestinian, but also you have a very close identification between the East Bank Jordanians and the monarchy, which has had its ups and downs, but which I think is in a steady state. So I would see Jordan not simply as imperiled, but actually as a possible linchpin for launching the counteroffensive against ISIS, and also for playing a constructive role in whatever order follows the Assad regime in Syria. In a way, Jordan is the ideal partner of the United States in the Middle East. It doesn't have the baggage that the Saudis have with their philandering in directions of extremism. It is it has an army which I think is effective. It is good at patrolling its borders and defending its sovereignty up to its borders. And so Jordan is the ideal ally. It should be at the top of the Obama administration's agenda as America's Arab friend in the Middle East. But it's not. It's not. Instead, it's seen as a sideshow. And I would hope, with Israel's encouragement, by the way, and Israel's done everything that it can also to strengthen Jordan in troubled times. It would do so again, I think, if Jordan were really threatened. It's time to put Jordan in the first place in America's regional alliance.
When I was a little boy growing up in Brooklyn, in a Jewish neighborhood, the standard gag was the Jewish grandfather who hears that the Dodgers are likely to win the pennant and looks worried and says, is it good or bad for the Jews? and I ask, of course, of a leading Israeli intellectual, is the mess right now good or bad or indifferent for Israel?
When you ask that question, you know, is it good for the Jews? The assumption is that, well, the Jews could make a decision one way or another which would affect the outcome. And I don't know that that's the case here. I'm skeptical about that. Israel can't fashion the region in which it finds itself. Certain threats have diminished with the changes we've seen. For example, conventional armies. Where are they? Where is the conventional army in the Arab world which is going to threaten Israel? Even Hezbollah, with which Israel went several rounds, has been preoccupied in Syria, fighting on behalf of the Assad regime. So if there was a danger in the latest contest with Hamas of a second front opening up in the north,
so this is a very important point, just before you continue, yeah. Martin. For most of Israel's existence, the fundamental strategic threat was that it would face a two-front or more war, that an army from Syria and an army from Egypt would close in on it, maybe with the Jordanians. And how can you fight on two fronts? This was the old German problem. They faced France and they faced Russia. That's now gone, is what Martin is saying, or diminished so significantly. But Israel faces other threats.
Yeah, and the other threats we saw exemplified over the summer in one form. These are these Islamist principalities which see themselves as being in perpetual war with Israel. There's no prospect of an agreement or understanding with them. and they are slowly building power. It is asymmetrical. They don't have the same wherewithal that Israel has, but they can create what is a disruption of Israeli society at such a level that it has profound implications throughout. And let me give you an example. One of the false analogies which was made, people were saying, well, what if, Israeli spokespeople were saying, what if you in the United States had people firing rockets on Texas from Mexico? I said, that's not the proper analogy. It's what if you had rockets falling on Chicago and Manhattan?
Yeah.
Tel Aviv is the very core and center of all of Israel's economic activity, the great majority of its cultural activity, 70% of the population. This is the center of the country, which was paralyzed, almost paralyzed, for the better part of a month.
But the solution to all of that, not solution, but the way of managing it, would really be the Hezbollah solution, namely Israel establishes deterrence by virtue of what the last war was, mm-hmm. just as it did in 2006. And in effect, Gaza is split off from the West Bank so that it's a separate statelet, call that or not, and deterred. No more tunnels, no more firing in. And then Israel still has to deal with the West Bank problem. That's the most optimistic conclusion I think you can draw from this. Does that sound reasonable, Martin?
Well, that is an optimistic conclusion. There's going to be continuing debate in Israel about whether in the long term Israel can coexist with a Gaza principality under Hamas. And you remember, in 1982, Israel made a different decision. It said we could not have the PLO in Beirut and on our borders, and they acted to remove the PLO, and the PLO basically disappeared. And there are people in Israel today who, until it was resuscitated in the Oslo process.
By the U.S.
By the U.S. There are people who today who say in Israel, that the day will come, maybe it wasn't this round, but it might be the next round or the next round after that, we'll have to do in Gaza what was done in Beirut. It will be much more costly than what was done this summer to both sides. But I think that's an open question. It's going to be heatedly debated in the Israeli political system as to what to do the next time.
I've got 4 or 5 minutes left. Therefore, I ask you to now indulge the historian's penchant for long-range thinking and even long-range projection. That is to say, allow Tennyson in all his love, all his fine silliness in Locksley Hall when he views the future as the time when the war drums throb no longer and the battle flags are furled in the Parliament of Man, the Federation of the World. World peace ultimately is coming. Think about not 10 years from now with regard to the Middle East, but think about 100, or if you want, 500. Will this ever end? Will there ever be a time when, in fact, we will look back with historical curiosity at the way in which that Middle East once was so befuddled and bemired in death, tragedy, confusion, misspent careers, and total dysfunctionality? Will that end? And if so, how and when?
Well, how did it end in Europe? Powerful forces came in from the outside and reordered Europe.
But only after it had thoroughly exhausted killed itself through internecine wars.
Yes. Now, why did outsiders come in and reorder Europe? First and foremost, the United States. Because Europe was a source of great industrial power. It could threaten the world. Its disorder, exported into world wars, could destroy and disorder the world. The Middle East isn't like that. The Middle East is a place in which very few of the states can even exercise power up to their borders. At this point in time, they don't have weapons of mass destruction. And so no one wants to make the investment in changing the Middle East, because the Middle East isn't threatening enough. There is no Imperial Japan there, right? There is no Nazi Germany there. And so everyone says, let's just contain the maladies of the Middle East and hope that they will blow over. Looking further down the line, I'd say that either Middle East undergoes some radical transformation from within, which we don't even see the beginnings of the signs of at this point in time, or at some point there'll be so much wherewithal will accumulate in the form, for example, of weapons of mass destruction in the hands of Iran and then other states, in which the wider world, led hopefully by the United States, which will still be a great power 50 years or 100 years from now, that's a hope, not a projection, will come and reorder. Now, the United States tried to do some reordering in the Iraq War, didn't have great results, said it wasn't worth the struggle, and walked away. Now it says, we have another threat coming, emerging in the form of ISIS. We'll go in, we'll meddle a little bit, maybe we'll be able to contain it. Question is whether there's anyone's going to come along and say, this needs the same treatment that we gave to Europe. This needs the same treatment that we gave to parts of East Asia, to put them as part of this community of mankind as equal and constructive partners in the development of humankind. And that's, I don't see that happening yet. And that's a tragedy of the Middle East. It's too weak to threaten, and because it's too weak to threaten, it's not worth the investment that the United States made. And every so often, some people talk about a Marshall Plan for the Middle East. But to have a Marshall Plan, right, you have to see the Marshall Plan as leading to the alleviation of something that threatens you fundamentally. The Middle East doesn't. And in that weakness, I think it's more likely to look like to take the place of Africa, really, as being the heart of darkness, which everyone is happy to neglect as long as there's no spillover.
Right. And I've studied the Marshall Plan. I know the Marshall Plan. The Marshall Plan was a friend of mine. And I can tell you that it was not only a lot of money, it had two other features that were very important. One was that there was a fixed short time in which the money was pumped in. We could see a good result that we thought would come out after that short pump priming. But the other crucial element was that we could have maximized our power by giving money directly to Germany, directly to France, directly to England. We told them, no, we will only give the money once you work together to create joint plans, and we will fund the joint plans. Nobody in the Middle East is really close to that, much less even with each other, much less including the Israelis, which are the dominant economy in the region. I would say one other point. We have another region to work on reordering first, and that's East Asia. with a growing China, and we do have a huge stake there. China wants a different role in East Asia. We've got to come up with a way, and China is acting in an aggressive nationalist fashion. Nationalism has cropped up again in Japan, which is very threatening to both the Koreans and the Chinese. The Chinese hate the Japanese, and so their nationalism is very conflictual. The Koreans have become more nationalist. We're going to have, and there's the threat of the meltdown in North Korea. So the United States, to the extent, that was the whole point of the pivot to Asia. We have much more interest there. So I would just say that the basic problem the United States faces is, in Aesop's fable, the difference between the hedgehog and the fox. The fox knows many things. The hedgehog knows one thing, one great big thing. And the United States, because of its global interest, is always in the position of the fox. It's got so many interests. And I think you're right in saying that the Middle East won't necessarily be at the top of that agenda in a positive way. It may be at the top of the agenda in a negative way if the lethality of bad actors continues to grow.
I think you're telling me that Tennyson's vision doesn't extend to the Middle East.
Well, I wanted to trump you. You're going back to the 19th century. I wanted to go back to ancient Greece, Milt. But I think we all know that only Milt Rosenberg could inject Tennyson into a discussion of the Middle East.
Well, we could indeed, except that time is gone, we could indeed inject Thucydides and the eternality of war, because all nations live with a jealous concern for interest. They want to grab what they can, and an equally paranoid concern for how the neighbors want to do the same. So you have to defend against them by preempting them. And also, you're guided by, and this is very important, I gather, in Islam, for you're guided by the ultimate search for honor. And honor is at issue in all the conflicts we're talking about. And my honor requires that I come to a close. With warm thanks to Martin Kramer and to Charles Lipson for joining us in this conversation.